This is Nick Treadwell, and you are listening to Nick Treadwell's Storyville.
Chapter 11. Remo looked at the high ceiling of the Folcroft Gymnasium, its climbing ropes lashed up like a telephone circuit's cluster of wires, then scuffed the tip of his Italian loafer across the highly varnished floor.
"This is where we first met," Chion said.
He wore a yellow morning robe and looked about the gymnasium as if it were a favored son.
"Yeah," said Remo, "and I tried to kill you."
"That is correct," said Chion. "Right then, I knew there was something about you I might be able to tolerate."
"But I wasn't able to do it, and you slapped me down good," said Remo.
"I remember. It was very satisfying."
"You would think so," said Remo.
"And then I taught you karate tricks and made them seem important."
"I never understood why you did that, Chion," said Remo. "What did karate have to do with Sin and you?"
"Nothing. But I knew these lunatics would never give me enough time to teach you anything correctly. So I gave you karate, which I thought you might be able to remember. But if I had said, 'This is karate,' it is useless foolishness for attacking anything except a piece of soft pine shelving, would you have listened?" "No. One must always feel that a gift has some value. I told you that karate was wonderful, marvelous, and would make you invincible. Then I proved it by attacking boards and doing tricks. Only that way could I manage to capture your attention for the 5 minutes a day necessary to teach you that game. However did they manage to toilet train you, Remo, when you forget everything so quickly?"
"Can that, little father. And then I left you and went out to kill the recruiter." Chion nodded.
"Yes, he was a good man. Mac Cleary. He had courage and intelligence."
"He picked me," Remo said.
"He had almost enough courage and intelligence to overcome his lapses in judgment," Chion said.
"Since then it's been you and me, Chion. How many years?"
27, Chion said.
"It hasn't been 27. 10, 12, 14 outside," Remo said.
"It seems like 27, Chion said. "I started out a young man. I gave you my youth, my best years. They have been frittered away in irritation, annoyance, a lack of true and proper respect, wasted on someone who eats meat and sneak cigarettes like a child."
Remo, who did not know that Chion had noticed his smoking, said quickly, It was only a couple. I wanted to see how they tasted after all these years."
"How did they taste?"
"Wonderful," Remo said.
"You give up the breathing so you can inhale particles of burning horse dung?" "This is true, Remo. They make those things from horse and cow droppings."
"They make them from tobacco. And no, I don't mean to give up my breathing. Can I do both?"
"How can you breathe? Breathing involves air, but your big white mouth is busy taking in smoke. They only tell you they make them out of tobacco. It is horse and cow droppings. This is the American way, the big profit that makes your whole country work."
"You sound like a communist."
"Do they smoke cigarettes?" asked Chion.
"Yes, made from horse and cow droppings. I've had them."
"Then I am no communist, just a poor, unpaid, misunderstood teacher who has failed to win the respect of his student."
"I respect you, Chion."
"Quit smoking."
"I will."
"Good.
Tomorrow." In front of Cheyenne, a pair of gymnastic rings hung from ceiling ropes. Without turning toward Remo, he swiped his hands at the hard plastic rings. They swung past him, their speed a blur, aimed at Remo's head like a boxer's 1-2 punch. Remo saw the one coming from the right-hand side first. He slipped to the left to avoid it and was hit in the forehead by the ring moving from the left. As he straightened up, the right ring, returning to its starting position, hit him in the back of the head. Cheyenne looked at him with disgust.
"Keep smoking. When they come for you, they will have you like a pork chop."
"You that sure they'll come for me?" asked Remo, rubbing his head.
"They will come. You are without hope, and don't ask me to help because I can't stand your breath."
He walked past Remo, out the gymnasium. Remo, still rubbing his head, looked at the gently swinging rings and wondered if he had lost that much of his edge already. Smith posted extra guards at the corridor outside Remo's room and distributed photos of Dr. Sheila Feinberg to be posted on the wall of Folcroft's gatehouse. If the woman appeared, she was to be admitted without a question, but Smith was to be notified at once. Smith thought of assigning a personal bodyguard to Remo to stay with him all the time, but realized Cheyenne would regard it as an insult. Assigning a guard to Remo with Cheyenne around would be like adding a Boy Scout patrol to the 7th Army for added firepower. There was nothing to do but wait. Smith did, in his office, reading the latest reports on 2 more deaths in Boston during the night. The governor had just declared martial law, which meant the city would be almost as well protected and patrolled as it had been before policemen were required to practice psychiatry, social work, and redemption. If Dostoevsky were alive today, he thought, he would have entitled his masterpiece just Crime. Crime and punishment would have no meaning to most of the general public. They had never heard of punishment. Smith waited. There had been 9 years of hard decisions, made cleanly and promptly. Now, when it had all been done and had come to this, Jackie Bell couldn't decide whether to wear the man-tailored brown suit, which had the virtue of being professional-looking, or the yellow scoop-neck dress, which had the virtue of being cool. She opted for cool, and as she dressed, thought how lucky she had been. Lucky enough to get out of the debilitating marriage, lucky enough to stay afloat financially during school years, lucky and smart enough to tough it out and become Jackie Bell, B.A., Jackie Bell, M.A., and finally, Jacqueline Bell, Ph.D., Dr. Jacqueline Bell. Her look still held right up to reading the American Psychoanalytical Journal and finding the advertisement for a job at Folcroft Sanitarium. There had been many applicants, but she'd been lucky enough to get the job from Dr. Smith. If anybody asked her who she thought should be her first patient in therapy at Folcroft, she would pick Harold W. Smith without hesitation. Throughout the interview, he had spoken without looking at her. He had been reading some kind of reports that came in over a computer terminal on his desk. He had stared at the telephone as if expecting it to leap in the air and try to strangle him. He had drummed pencils, looked out his strangely brown-tinted windows, and finally, after asking her the same question 3 times, told her the job was hers. As she inspected herself in the full-length mirror on the back of the bedroom door in the 3-room apartment she'd been lucky to find, she shrugged. There were worse cases in the world than Dr. Smith, she supposed. At least he had enough sanity left to hire her. She had tried to find out what his doctorate was in because he did not have M.D. after his name on the door, but he had not volunteered any information, except to tell her she would be on her own. He would not look over her shoulder. He would not question her professional decisions, and in fact would be most happy if he never had to talk to her again. That would be okay with her, too. He'd get no complaints from her. She counted herself lucky to get the job. It used to be that a bachelor's degree would guarantee a job. Then college classrooms turned into places that ladled out relevant education like courses in soap opera for students who could barely read and write, and the BA was devalued. It took a master's degree to get a job. Then the same thing happened to the master's degree. So it took a PhD to get a job, but only for a while. Soon, it too was considered worthless. People who hired others went back to using Tennessee Windage and simple reading and writing tests to determine what potential employee might be able to find his way to work in the morning without a keeper. No degree guaranteed a job anymore because no degree guaranteed that its holder had an education that went beyond 1, 2, 3 many. The only good thing about it at all, Jackie Bell reflected, was that the doctors of education who started it were all in the same bag. They found their doctorates were meaningless too, and they had trouble getting work. Of course, being educated men, they decided they had nothing to do with it. It was all the fault of the evil, corrupt, capitalist society. She remembered something she had once read in a book of political essays. He who creates the deluge often gets wet. Dr. Jacqueline Bell approved of her image in the mirror and brushed imaginary lint off her left shoulder. The doorbell rang. She was not expecting anyone, but it might be someone from the sanitarium. Because she had not grown up in New York City, Chicago, or Los Angeles, she went right to the door and opened it without asking who was there. A woman stood there, a beautiful woman with long blonde hair, eyes that slanted in an almost feline fashion, and a body so breathtakingly and breakneckly poured into her clothes she made Jackie feel instant tacky. The woman smiled, showing the most perfect white teeth Jackie had ever seen. "Dr. Bell?" the woman asked. Jackie nodded. "I'm glad to meet you. I'm Dr. Feinberg." "Oh, are you from Fulcroft?" "Yes. They asked me to stop by and pick you up on my way in this morning." "This is my lucky day," Jackie said. "It's so hot, out there, I don't relish the walk." She stood aside and waved Dr. Feinberg into the apartment. "We're early, by the way," Jackie said. "Have you eaten yet? Why not have a bite with me?" "Exactly what I had in mind," she said. Cheyenne said, "Why are those people in blue uniforms in the halls? Did you put them there?" "That is correct, Master of Sin and Jew," Smith said formally. "Why?" asked Cheyenne. He had stopped calling Smith Emperor. It seemed appropriate when he was away from Fulcroft and met Smith infrequently, but close up, Cheyenne dropped the convention lest Smith think it was an acknowledgement that Smith was of a higher rank than Cheyenne. "Because I am worried that those people might find Remo. I want him protected." "How could they find him here?" asked Cheyenne. "Because I have told them where he is," Smith said. "That is a very good reason," Cheyenne said slowly. "Cheyenne, we have to get these creatures. I know you may be upset because I'm possibly endangering Remo's life,
but I have to look at more than that. I have to think of the whole country. And on its own, how many masters of sin and Jew has this wonderful country produced? Cheyenne asked.
On its own? None, Smith said.
And you think the country is worth Remo's life, nevertheless?
If you put it on those terms, yes, Smith said.
Worth Remo's and mine? Asked Cheyenne.
Yes.
Remo's, mine, and yours? Cheyenne persisted.
Smith nodded.
How many lives does it take before it is no longer worth those lives?
Cheyenne spat on the floor of Smith's office.
Remo's life, just because some fat people in some chilly city got themselves eaten.
It's not just them, and it's not just Boston. Unless we can stop these creatures, it could spread nationwide, worldwide, perhaps even to Sin and Jew.
Sin and Jew will be safe, Cheyenne said.
They can even get to Korea, Cheyenne.
But Sin and Jew exist where Remo and I exist. Where we are, there is Sin and Jew. I will see that Remo stays safe, Cheyenne said. For you and your emperor, there may be no safety, but Remo and I will survive.
For a moment, the two men's eyes locked, until Smith turned away from Cheyenne's burning hazel eyes.
I wanted to ask you something, he said. Remo just doesn't seem right.
It's not just that he's injured, Smith said. He's smoking, and last night he ate a steak. When was the last time he ate any meat besides duck and fish? What's happening to him, Cheyenne?
His body has suffered a shock from his injuries, a shock so great his body has forgotten what it is.
Smith looked puzzled. I don't understand.
Sometimes, when someone suffers mental shock, they have what you call the forget disease.
Amnesia, Smith suggested.
Yes, the body may suffer the same illness Remo's has. His body is returning to where it was before I undertook his training. There is no way of stopping it from happening.
Does that mean that's it for him? That Remo's done? His special skills are done?
No one knows that, said Cheyenne. His body may return all of the way to where he began, or may stop only part of the way there. It may stop anywhere and never again change, or may reach bottom, then return to what it was before his injury. There is no way to tell, because each man is different.
Yes, I know.
I would think you forgot, Cheyenne said. Since you regard Remo as just another man, just another target for these tiger people, without considering he is a master of Sin and Jew too.
Cheyenne's eyes narrowed with intensity. Smith could feel, as he so often did when dealing with Remo and Cheyenne, that he faced an elemental life and death force. Smith suspected he was on a swaying bridge. Fortunately, he's Shiva, the destroyer god, isn't he? He essayed a small smile, pushing it into the conversation like inadequate seed money.
Yes, he is, said Cheyenne. But even the dead night tiger can be victim to the tiger people. What happens to him will be on your hands and your head. Now, if you would be wise, you will keep those guards and their guns away from Remo's room, because I will be there.
Cheyenne had stood during the conversation. Now he spun and walked away, red robe trailing behind as if he were a bride racing down the aisle of a church because she was late and they'd started the wedding without her. He turned back at the door.
When Remo is well enough, he and I are leaving. You will deal with your tiger people yourself, because he will be elsewhere.
Where will you go? Smith asked glumly.
Anywhere. out of your employ."
Sheila Feinberg restrained herself from laughing aloud when she saw the picture of herself in the guards building just inside the large stone wall surrounding Fulcroft Sanitarium. It was a picture of the old Sheila Feinberg with hooked nose, saggy eyes, and the desperate hairdo. It told Sheila clearly, and not without some shock, how ugly she had been before the changeover. It told her, too, that Fulcroft was one giant trap waiting to spring shut. "Who's that? Your wife?" Sheila asked the guard, a gaunt man with a disproportionate beer belly and sweat rings showing on his blue shirt under his armpits. "No, praise God," he said, smiling at the beautiful buxom blonde standing in front of him. "Just some dip we're supposed to keep an eye out for. Maybe an escaped patient or something. Look at her, she won't be back. Probably went and joined the circus." He smiled harder at Sheila. "Anyway, I'm not married," he lied. Sheila nodded. "Those kind of people will be your responsibility now, I guess, the guard said. He looked again at the letter of appointment to the Psycho Services Division. "That is all in order. What you do, Doctor, is go inside. Your division is on the right wing of the main building. When you get yourself organized, get yourself an ID card. Then you won't have any more trouble at the gate. Of course, when I'm on, you won't have any trouble, because I'm not likely to forget you." He handed back the letter. Sheila moved in closer to take it from him and brushed her body against his. The guard watched her walk away and felt a tingle in his groin he hadn't felt since his second year of marriage, 8 emotional centuries ago. A tingle he thought was no longer possible. Who knew? One thing he had learned from working at Fulcroft was that shrinks were nuttier than the people they were supposed to treat. Maybe this one liked old skinny guards with beer bellies. He looked at her name again on the sign-in sheet. Jackie Bell. Dr. Jackie Bell. It had a nice ring to it. A white coat and clipboard are passports in any healing institution in the world. When she got them from a hall closet, Sheila Feinberg was free to roam Fulcroft as she wished. She quickly realized the big L-shaped main building was divided into two parts. The front section of the old brick structure was given over to the sanitarium's main business, treating patients. But the south wing, the base of the L, was different. It housed computers and offices on the first floor. Upstairs were hospital rooms. On a lower level, built into the natural slope of the land, was a gymnasium that stretched almost to the back of Fulcroft's property, where old boat docks gnawed like arthritic fingers into the still waters of Long Island Sound. And sealing off the entire wing were guards. At a different time in her life, Sheila Feinberg might have wondered just what was going on that required such security in a sanitarium, but she no longer cared about that. She cared about finding Remo, and she knew he was in the building's south wing. Sheila went back to the main building and posed in the special service office for a Polaroid picture. "Interesting place," she said to the young woman, Clark, who ran the office. "Not bad. They leave you alone, which is better than some jobs I've had." "My first day," Sheila said. "By the way, what's in the south wing that they have so many guards? Some special thing?" "It's always like that. I hear from the grapevine they've got a special rich patient there." The girl cut the photograph's edge with a paper cutter and mounted the picture on heavy card using rubber cement. "They do some kind of government research over there, computers and stuff. I guess they don't want to take a chance on damaging the equipment." Sheila was more interested in the special rich patient.
"That rich man over there, is he married?"
she asked with a smile. The young girl shrugged as she placed the photo in a machine that looked like a credit card printer. She pressed a switch and the top of the machine lowered. There was a faint hiss of air and Sheila could smell the acrid fumes of heated plastic.
"I don't know if he's married. He's got his own servant with him, an old Oriental. Here you are, doctor. Pin this on your coat and you can go anywhere."
"Even the South Wing?"
"Anywhere. You can't treat your nutcases if you can't get to them," the girl said.
"Yeah," Sheila said. Sheila skipped lunch in the main dining room and strolled down the rocky ground behind the buildings leading to the old docks. They were obviously unused, but still looked sturdy enough. She filed that information away in her head. Looking back at the main building, she was surprised to see the glass in the south wing was mirrored, one-way glass. People inside could see out, but no one outside could see in. She thought for a moment that the white man might even be watching her. The thought, instead of frightening her, made her tingle with anticipation. She yawned, a big cat's yawn, then smiled at the second-floor windows over the gymnasium building. After lunch, her badge got her past the guards outside the second-floor entrance to the south wing. She was in an ordinary hospital corridor, exuding its traditional scent, Clorox and dead air. She did not have to see Remo to know where he was. She smelled him as she walked along the narrow corridor. She followed the scent to the room near the end of the hall. The scent was Remo's, but was somehow different. There was an acrid smell of something having been burned. She recognized it as cigarette fumes. She neared Remo's door. For a moment, the urge to push the door open and walk in was almost overpowering. She caught herself when she sensed another scent. It was the smell of jasmine and herbs. It came from the old Oriental. She had smelled it in the Boston attic apartment after she had cleared her nose of the pepper that had been sprinkled in the hallway. The room number was 221B. She went down another corridor and found a stairway that opened onto a fire escape leading down the outside of the building. At the corner of the building, the fire escape platform split and ran all around the outside of the patient's room on the second floor. Perfect, she thought. Perfect. And she went back to the psychoservices department in the main building to kill time and draw a plan. In room 221B, Cheyenne said to Remo, who was puffing gently on a cigarette,
"They are here."
"Now, how do you know that?" Remo asked. He was a little weary of Cheyenne's alarms about tiger people. What would be nice, he thought, would be a Caribbean vacation and a large pina colada.
"The same way you would have known it but a week ago," Cheyenne said, "with my senses."
"Forget it," Remo said.
"They are here, nonetheless," repeated Cheyenne dully.
How could he save Rio from the tigers when Remo was not only unable to protect himself, but didn't even seem to care? Moments ago, footsteps in the hallway moved toward the door, stopped, then retreated rapidly. They were not the footsteps of a normal human. Instead of the infinitesimal time lag between putting down the heel and putting down the sole of the foot, these footsteps had come down with one faint but continuous sound, as if the bottom of the foot were round and padded like a tiger's.
"You take care of them," Remo was saying. "I'm thinking about pork chops and apple sauce and mashed potatoes."
"Yeah. Pork chops."
Three members of Sheila Feinberg's pack who had accompanied her to Rye, New York, entered Fulcroft that night by going over the wall. She told them at precisely the time she told them, 8 p.m. sharp. At 8:12 p.m., they hit the corridor leading to Remo's room. The guard who had been stationed inside the hallway had been pulled off duty by Smith at Cheyenne's demand. No one was there to stop the three as they sniffed and growled their way down the corridor toward room 221B, where Remo lay in bed, his belly full of lobster and pork chop. But the three were not seen or unheard. In Remo's room, Cheyenne rose from his small grass mat and moved so quietly toward the door, Remo did not hear him stir. But Dr. Smith, in his office directly below the corridor, glanced at a television monitor and saw two women and a man walking down the hall. What he saw gave him a chill, the kind he had not felt since witnessing the results of Nazi atrocities in World War II. The three tiger persons hunched over, their fingers almost touching the floor as they moved from closed door to closed door, sniffing. One turned directly in front of the stationary hall television camera. Her lips were pulled back, exposing her teeth. Her eyes glinted inhumanly. Smith realized for the first time just how much animal and how little human these tiger people had become. He yanked open his center desk drawer, grabbed a .45 caliber automatic, and ran from his office to the flight of stairs leading to the upstairs corridor. Cheyenne waited inside the door of the hospital room while Remo started to sit up in bed.
"They are here," Cheyenne said.
"I gathered that," Remo said.
"So, what are you doing?" asked Cheyenne.
"Going to help."
"Help who do what?" "Rest your bloated belly."
"Just because I ate something good doesn't mean I can't help you," Remo said. Cheyenne turned away in disgust, dismissing Remo with a wave of his hand. Outside the door, the three tiger people scratched on the fire-retardant metal covering the wooden door. All they had to do was turn the knob to enter the room, but they did not. They scratched at it. Their fingernails made a soft, insistent noise, like the mewing of cats left outside by mistake with night coming on. They purred. Smith pushed through the set of double fire doors leading to the corridor. He choked back a gasp at the sight of three persons scratching on the door. He moved to the corner of the hallway where he could not be surprised by anyone who might follow him through the doorway. He raised his gun and called out, "All right, all of you, away from that door, down on the floor." The three turned to him. The expressions on their faces would have been appropriate only if Harold W. Smith was a lamb chop. Inside the hospital room, Cheyenne and Remo heard Smith's voice.
"What is that idiot doing here?" Cheyenne said.
The three members of Sheila Feinberg's pack moved away from the door towards Smith, their arms raised over their heads, fingers curled in imitation of deadly claws, mouths open and drooling.
"That'll do," Smith said coldly. "Hold it right there." The gun was unwavering in his right hand, near his hip.
The two women and a man kept moving toward him. Smith waited until they were away from the door and repeated his command.
"The three of you, down on the floor!"
But instead of dropping, the three separated and came at Smith, breaking into a run, charging, growling. Smith fired a shot which hit the man's chest and lifted him off his feet before plunking him back onto the marble floor. In room 221B, Remo started up again from bed.
"That's Smitty. He needs help," he said.
"Get back in bed,"
Screw it, little father, I'm helping.
You, said Chion disdainfully. I will go.
He pushed his way out into the hall and left Remo sitting, strangely tired and empty, on the edge of the bed. On the fire escape outside Remo's room, Sheila Feinberg rose to her feet from the position in which she had lain for the last 4 hours. She stretched once. Her muscles were loose and ready. She looked through a tiny scratch she had found in the corner of the mirrored window in Remo's room and saw Chion going out into the hallway. As the door closed around him, Sheila, with a running start, threw her body against the window, crashed through it, and landed gently on her feet alongside Remo's bed. Remo looked at her with shock. She purred at him.
Hello, my sweet meat, she said. I've missed you.
In the hall, the two women crouched in front of Smith, separated from each other and from him by 5 feet. Smith seemed reluctant to fire. He covered first one and then the other with his automatic and again ordered them to lie flat on the floor. They hissed. Chion saw tensing of the calf muscles protruding from under the woman's skirts. The attack leap was impending. Like a cold blue wind, he moved between the women and Smith. He slapped the gun away from Smith's hand. It hit the floor with a loud metallic clank, like a hammer, dropped onto ceramic tile. The women leapt at Smith, but Chion was between them and their target. A raised left hand stopped one of the women as completely as if she had impaled herself full speed on a spear. The second woman turned her head to give her open mouth a clean bite at Chion's throat. He merely slid below the woman's head and came up, almost casually, with an elbow into a point slightly above the pit of the woman's stomach. The air went out of her breath with a sibilant hiss and she fell onto the other woman. Smith brushed past Chion and knelt over the two women.
They're dead, he said.
Of course, said Chion.
I wanted them alive, Smith said.
They wanted you dead, said Chion. Maybe they were wiser than you. He looked at them. Neither is the one who was here earlier.
Chion ran toward the hospital room, Smith following at his heels. When they entered the room, it was empty. Broken glass from the window cluttered the floor. Chion ran to the window and looked out. On the ground below, running toward the docks behind Folcroft, was a woman. She carried Remo's body over her shoulder, seemingly without effort, like a big man carrying a small rug.
Aye! Chion screamed and leaped through the jagged glass of the window. Smith leaned out the window in time to see Chion leap over the fire escape railing, drop 2 stories to the ground, and land running. Smith clambered onto the fire escape, careful not to slash himself on the glass shards, and followed down the stairs. Ahead he saw, docked at the pier, a 29-foot Silverton cabin cruiser with outriggers and a bimini top. The woman dumped Remo onto the back of the boat and slipped the bowline from the rusted old cleat at the end of the dock. Then she jumped aboard. Chion was now 40 feet from the dock. He was on the dock when the twin engines of the big boat roared and the craft skidded forward, its nose in the air, into the darkness, dropping over the chill waters of the Sound. A few moments later, Smith stood alongside Chion, watching the boat, running without lights, vanish into the deepening night. Smith felt required to put a hand on Chion's shoulder. The old man seemed not to feel it, and looking at him, Smith realized how small and frail was this 80-year-old Korean who knew so much about many things. Smith squeezed Chion's shoulder in friendship and in the sharing sense of camaradeship that comes to people who have suffered a mutual loss.
My son is dead, Chion said.
No, Chion, he's not dead.
He will be dead, Chion repeated,
His voice was flat and soft, as if shock had robbed his vocal cords of the ability to register even the slightest emotion.
"Because he can no longer protect himself."
"He won't be dead," Smith said firmly. "Not if I have anything to say about it." He turned and strode purposely back to Fulcroft headquarters. He had work to do, and the night was young.